5. At 2 o'clock, the wedding party assembled on the beach of Lake Wyndham for a photo session. I assumed it would be a small and private affair, but as with the rehearsal, there were dozens of guests milling around and enjoying the pre-show spectacle. There was even a bartender mixing cocktails up near Osprey Lodge. It was the man from Mom and Dad's restaurant, the same man who claimed the gardeners deserved more credit for all the good things they'd brought to the community. He already had a long line of guests waiting for a drink. Meanwhile, Maggie and her bridesmaids were out on the dock, posing in front of the lake, while a team of photographers snapped camera shutters, and a videographer captured wide panoramic shots. A woman with cat's eye glasses and a clipboard was shouting instructions. Show me shy. Show me demure. Okay, now show me flirty. Show me sexy. Come on, ladies, vamp it up. Show me those bedroom eyes. They say there's nothing quite like seeing your daughter in her wedding dress on her big day. It's the last major milestone of fatherhood, a huge emotional moment for every dad. But when I looked at Maggie, I just felt numb. Her lace-tiered ball gown reportedly cost $15,000 and came from a famous designer based in Paris. But I thought it looked flimsy and insubstantial, like the costumes for sale at a Halloween store. I dragged an Adirondack chair into the shade of the trees and sat down to watch the photo shoot. More and more guests were wandering out to the lawn. The men wore summer suits in neutral shades of blue or light gray, while the women were a bit more showy in brightly colored gowns. I wondered if any of the capacity employees knew my daughter's secret. Surely there had to be rumors. Any time a young woman straight out of college starts joining the boss on international work trips, there's bound to be gossip and speculation. Yet, everyone I'd met seemed convinced Maggie was a rare and extraordinary talent who'd earned her place in senior management. I suppose it's easy to make a person believe something when their paycheck depends on their believing it. A trio emerged from the crowd to approach me. Errol Gardner pushed a wheelchair occupied by his wife, and they were accompanied by a man who looked strangely familiar. Errol wore a black tuxedo and dark sunglasses that helped to conceal the bruise I'd left on his face, and Catherine scarcely resembled the woman I'd met the night before. Her makeup was subtle and very precise. Her hair was clean and artfully styled. She wore an elegant sequined gown with pearl earrings and a glittering diamond necklace. Above all, she was medicated within an inch of her life. Her hands were folded in her lap, and she cast her blank stare all over the lawn, seemingly overwhelmed by so much movement and activity. Errol proceeded like this was our first introduction. Catherine, this is Frank, Margaret's father. He's very excited to meet you. I thought I saw a flicker of recognition in her eyes. A small sign she remembered our conversation from the previous evening, but she simply apologized for not coming downstairs sooner.
My medicines aren't working so well, she said, in a voice scarcely louder than a whisper. I'm afraid they've left me very fatigued.
The doctors ordered her to stay in bed, Errol explained, but she refused to listen. She said there was no way she'd miss this ceremony. I was ready to suggest that we all just cut the bullshit when the third person spoke up, and his voice was instantly familiar. I'm glad you made that decision, Catherine. No mother should ever have to miss her son's wedding. The man was my age, bald, with a face I knew I'd recognized, but I was seeing him out of context and simply couldn't place him. Frank, I'd like to introduce you to a good friend of mine, Errol said. This is Armando Castado. I believe you two work together. Holy Mother of God, I suddenly found myself shaking hands with the Chief Executive Officer of the United Parcel Service.
It's a real pleasure to meet you, Frank. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Costado.
Armando, please.
Okay, all right. Armando.
I was so blindsided, I managed to forget the events of the last 72 hours and focus on the immediate present.
What are you doing here?
The gardeners invited me, and Margaret, of course. We've all been working together these past few months, so I was pretty excited to receive their invitation. And when I learned the father of the bride was a fellow UPSer, that just sealed the deal.
Circle of honor, right?
Yes, 26 years. Armando took a moment to explain the circle of honor to Errol and Catherine. He said that only a small fraction of UPS drivers ever managed to join its ranks because going 25 years without a scratch was nearly impossible. It takes extraordinary skill, discipline, and intelligence, day after day and mile after mile. Most people simply cannot do it.
I know I couldn't do it, Errol said. Just last week I dinged my bumper at the airport.
Catherine smiled uneasily and stared down at her hands. I didn't think she could follow the conversation at all.
A waiter came by with a tray of champagne glasses and asked if we were interested in a little pre-wedding celebration. Armando took flutes for everyone and passed them around.
Let's raise a glass to the father of the bride, he said.
Remember, Frank, you're not losing a daughter. You're gaining a son. Congratulations.
Hear, hear, Errol said.
Then he held a glass to his wife's lips. Champagne dribbled down her chest and into her lap, but we all pretended not to notice. I suppose I had fully resigned myself to the situation. I realized that if I ignored everything I'd learned in the last 24 hours, the wedding was everything I dreamed it would be. The sky was clear, the sun was shining, my daughter and her bridesmaids looked beautiful. My new in-laws had graciously welcomed me and Tammy into their extended family, and now the CEO of my company was showering me with praise. All I had to do was relax, drink the delicious champagne, and repeat all the old familiar clichés. We couldn't have asked for a better day. Marriage was hard, but well worth it. Grow old with me. The best is yet to be.
A photographer hurried over and interrupted our conversation.
We need all the family members on the dock, please. Moms and both dads. Everybody get their smiles ready.
We'll talk more at dinner, Armando promised. Good luck at the ceremony, Frank. It's going to be wonderful.
I followed my in-laws down to the beach, where all the groomsmen and bridesmaids and Maggie were waiting. Aiden was running late, so the photographers were ticking off the shots that didn't require him. Me and Maggie and Tammy, and of course, me and Errol Gardner, with Maggie standing between us.
Big smiles, Frank, the photographer called, clicking the shutter again and again. Look happy. Oh, that's perfect. That's wonderful.
As soon as we finished, I called to the waiter for a second glass of champagne. I realized that if I was going to make it through the ceremony, I would need to give Catherine Gardner a run for her money. By 2:30, Errol was confronting the groomsmen and asking what the hell was taking Aiden so damned long. No one had a satisfactory answer. No one had seen him in more than an hour. They'd all tried texting Aiden on their phones, and he'd replied with numerous assurances that he was on his way. The clipboard lady promised everything would be fine. She said it would be easy to take the remaining photographs after the ceremony.
It's normal for grooms to get confused, she assured us. I bet Aiden went straight to the Globe, and now he's wondering where we are.
I thought this seemed unlikely, but the clock was ticking, and there was a consensus that we all needed to move to the ceremony. I followed the crowd up the lawn and watched Abigail processing in front of the bride, clearing a path for my daughter to follow. Tammy sidled up alongside me.
You look very handsome, little brother. I'm glad you're finally getting into the spirit of things.
I don't think the groom is coming.
Of course he is. Don't jinx us.
He's gone, Tammy. My heart felt light as I voiced the idea, as if a crushing burden had been lifted. I think he came to his senses and got the hell out of here.
Oh, you think he just drove out the front gate with Hoo-Ho and his whole SWAT team on standby? Don't bet on it, Frankie.
One of the photographers walked alongside us, snapping candids, and my sister's cheerful smile didn't falter.
He'll be waiting at the Globe.
But she was wrong. When we arrived at the outdoor theater, there was still no sign of Aiden, and the ceremony was due to start in 20 minutes. Now everyone was texting the groom, but no one was getting a reply. Errol sent Jerry to check Osprey Lodge, and Hoo-Ho radioed his team and ordered a full sweep of the property. I was surprised that no one proposed a visit to Aiden's studio, the place he always used to escape the chaos of Osprey Cove.
You discovered my little secret, he had said to me. Most people don't even know it's here.
Without a word to the others, I ducked into the woods to check the studio myself. I still remembered the route from 2 days earlier, when I followed Aiden and Gwendolyn to the outer boundaries of the property. After several minutes of walking, I checked the time and then quickened my pace. It was just about 2:45, and I realized that if my hunch was wrong, if Aiden wasn't at the studio, I'd never make it back to the Globe in time. I'd miss the chance to walk my daughter down the aisle. But when I finally arrived at the cottage, the door was unlocked. I stepped inside. There was no sign of Aiden, but I didn't feel alone. The black and white faces watched me with their strange, haunted expressions. I stopped at the spiral staircase and peered down through the hole in the floor. At the bottom was a faint glimmer of light.
Aiden? Is that you?
Don't come down here, Frank.
Everyone's looking for you. Jerry, Hoo-Ho, the photographers.
Fuck them.
I didn't know how to answer that. I turned around in a circle, casting a glance around the studio and surveying all the paintings in progress. I recognized one of the subjects as Gwendolyn, her eyes slightly lowered, looking out at the viewer with a shy and slightly flirtatious smile.
I'm coming downstairs, Aiden.
Please, don't.
His voice was shaking, like he was engaged in some kind of physical exertion.
Just leave, and don't tell anyone I'm here.
Aiden, I just want to make an observation, okay? You don't need to go through with this wedding. I know you lied to the police to protect your mother. That's an honorable thing. Anyone would understand why you did it. But Maggie lied, too. You're both guilty of the same thing. So if you call off this wedding, she can't hurt you. She's powerless.
If you think she's powerless, you don't know her very well.
Believe me, I know her better than anyone. I've just spent a lot of time unwilling to see the truth.
One pretty obvious tenet of situational awareness is that you never want to voluntarily enter a dark basement with just one exit. But I knew I would never convince Aiden of anything until we talked face to face. So I ignored my better instincts and descended the staircase. The steps were short and narrow, and I had to grip the steel pole and twist my body into unnatural positions just to reach the bottom. I found myself in a kind of small, cramped vestibule with a round metal door, like the entrance to a bank vault. Just beyond was a tunnel, lined with tall metal shelves, still well stocked with provisions after all these years. There were large rusted cans of stewed tomatoes, creamed corn, pork and beans, tuna fish, and Del Monte fruit cocktail. There were moldering cardboard boxes labeled biscuits, survival, all-purpose, and enormous barrels marked drinking water, and lots of vintage 1950s household products. Charmin toilet paper, Ajax detergent, Ivory soap, and Ever-Ready batteries, plus a small library of paperback novels, how-to manuals, and sets of encyclopedias. The entire shelter had the musty, pleasant smell of a used bookstore. At the far end of the tunnel, the passage widened into a kind of living area with a sofa, a dining table with chairs, and four pairs of army-style bunk beds. Aiden sat at the head of the table, dressed in his black tuxedo, as if welcoming me to a formal dinner. On the table before him was an open metal case containing a black Colt revolver. Because a bomb shelter would need to be defended from external threats, after all, and the builders had prepared for every worst-case scenario. "Don't come any closer, Frank. You should have stayed upstairs." "Talk to me, Aiden. What are you thinking right now?" He wouldn't look at me. I glanced at the gun, but I couldn't tell if it was loaded. After 60 years in a musty, humid basement, I didn't know if the weapon would still fire properly, or if the bullets were still functional, and I didn't want to know. "You're the only person in this camp that I trust," I told him. "If anything happens to you, I don't think I'll be safe here." "You'll be fine, Frank. I went by your cottage a little while ago. I left a gift in your suitcase."
"What kind of gift?"
"You'll see. It's enough to protect you. Don't worry."
There was a kind of resigned sadness in his voice, like he had no intention of ever leaving the basement. "Aiden, listen to me. I have a friend of a friend who works for the Wall Street Journal. It sounds like they're already investigating your family. I bet they know people who would help you."
"Frank, if I talk to the Wall Street Journal, your daughter is going to be in an awful lot of trouble."
"I'm not worried about her. Right now, I'm just worried about you and the gun on the table. Could you close that case for me, please?" He shook his head, still refusing to make eye contact. His face was flushed. Clearly, he had been crying. "I have an idea, Aiden. Right now, everyone's waiting for you back at the Globe. Let's use this moment to get out of here."
"How do you mean?"
"I mean, leave Osprey Cove. Never come back." He chuckled.
"As if it's that easy. I'm sure they've got Hu-Ho on high alert. We'd never make it past him."
"How about the fence? Is there a section that's broken? Some place we could get through?"
"Not that I've ever seen. We could go look, but there's always security walking the perimeter."
"What about the lake?"
"You want to swim?"
"We can take your father's boat. They can't stop us once we're on the water. There are too many witnesses. All those sailboats. We'll cross the lake and find some town, and I'll call the Taggarts."
"Those people hate me. They won't help us."
"They will if you start telling the truth. Your parents ruined their lives. They deserve to know what really happened." I could tell that he agreed with me, but I could also see he was terrified. "Look, Aiden, if you won't do this for yourself, and you won't do it for the Taggarts, how about you do it for Gwendolyn? She liked you. She cared about you. She wanted you to stand up for yourself. And look what they did to her. I know you must feel awful about it." He still wouldn't look at me, but he nodded his head, and I knew I was reaching him. "If she was still alive, she'd want you to put away the gun and come upstairs with me."
"You're right. She would.
But we need to go now, before people start leaving the Globe." It was already 3:10. We'd have to run if we were going to make it. We'd be very conspicuous in our tuxedos and black Oxford shoes, but maybe, with enough of a head start, we could do it. "Are you ready?"
Aiden thought for a moment before answering. I told Gwen the marriage was just for show. I said it was only going to last a year, and in the meantime I was free to see other people. But she refused to play along. She was too principled. She said she wanted nothing to do with me. Not unless I turned my back on all the money and told the truth.
Then Aiden stood up and straightened his jacket like he had finally resolved to do just that. He closed the lid on the gun, locked the case, and returned it to a high shelf.
I know a shortcut we can take, he said. There's a path through the woods that'll get us to the boathouse.
Let's hurry, I told him.
I followed Aiden up the spiral staircase and across the studio, but as we approached the door, I heard footsteps on the porch outside and realized my miscalculation. It was indeed 3:10, but in the world of the gardeners, it was already 3:25. They'd already had plenty of time to start looking for us. Aiden opened the door to discover not just his father and Jerry Levinson, but Hu-Ho, too.
Aiden, what are you doing here? His father was furious. We've got 300 people waiting.
His son turned on his heel and ran back to the stairs. I lunged to stop him, but wasn't quick enough. I called his name, but he just spiraled down into the hole. Errol turned his rage on me.
And what are you doing? Why aren't you at the Globe?
I ignored him. I ran to the top of the stairs and called down to the cellar.
Aiden, wait, please!
And then we all heard it. A single loud pop, amplified and echoing off the basement's hard concrete walls. And I knew the wedding was off. 6. Within an hour, the catering staff was stacking chairs and clearing all the tables. They shook out all 300 artfully folded linen napkins. They collected all the silverware and sorted the utensils into plastic trays. Dinner plates, salad plates, and bread plates were stacked onto dish dollies. Tablecloths were swept into bins to be laundered and pressed. Guests were encouraged to take home a centerpiece so the flowers wouldn't go to waste. And the subtext of the invitation was clear. Please depart as quickly as possible, so our family can grieve in private. A terrible accident was the term used by guests who approached me to express their condolences. I suppose it was the most polite thing to say. Let's all pretend Aiden entered a bomb shelter to clean a vintage handgun at the precise moment he was supposed to be speaking his vows. But as soon as these guests turned their backs to me, I could see them congregating and comparing notes. It was an open secret that Aiden had been in therapy for years, that he'd always been aloof and a bit of a loner. He had an artist's temperament. The subjects of his paintings always looked so troubled, and of course he'd just lost a dear friend to a drug overdose. Clearly he'd been suffering and internalizing a great deal of pain. And it was so easy to overlook all the warning signs. Luxury buses shuttled the hotel guests back into town, and by 4:30 the cottages were emptying out. Still dressed in my tuxedo, I grabbed a bench on Main Street and watched the guests dragging their rolling bags out to their vehicles. Whenever possible, they avoided making eye contact. No one really knew what to say. It was one of those awful situations where words were simply inadequate. One of the few people who did try to speak with me was Armando Castado. He sat beside me on the bench and gave me a business card with his personal phone number, and he encouraged me to use it. Anytime you need someone to listen, I hope you'll reach out to me. I'll be waiting for your call, Frank. I had no intention of ever discussing this incident with anyone, especially not Armando Castado, but I appreciated the gesture. Thank you. Margaret will get through this, he promised. With your love and support, your daughter is going to be fine.
I wasn't so sure of that. I hadn't seen Maggie since I'd left everyone at the Globe, but I'd heard she was somewhere inside the lodge, grieving in private with Aiden's parents, and I couldn't bring myself to join them. Immediately after the gunshot, Hu-Ho cautioned all of us to stay upstairs while he went down the spiral stairs to investigate. He said it was safer if he went alone. Errol and Jerry were happy to oblige, but I followed Hu-Ho anyway. To this day, I wish I hadn't. I'll never unsee what we found in the basement. Aiden lay sprawled on the floor, and most of his head was dripping down the wall. And yet, somehow, the rest of his body was still alive. He was still moving. I reached for my phone to call 911, but Hu-Ho smacked the device out of my hand. "Don't be stupid." I went to retrieve it, and he shoved me against the wall, then chopped my lower back with the sharp edge of his hand. I felt like I'd been tasered. I would have collapsed if Hu-Ho wasn't right behind me, twisting my arm and pinning me to the wall and forcing me to endure the horrible wheezing gasps of Aiden's last breaths. Hu-Ho calmly whispered it would only be another minute, and it felt like the longest minute of my life. To this day, I'll sometimes hear a random stranger clearing their throat in a bar or restaurant, and suddenly I'll be back in the basement, my face pressed to the cool cinder block wall, immobilized and unable to help. When at last the breathing finally stopped, Hu-Ho released me, and I fell to the floor. He announced that it was safe for Errol and Jerry to come downstairs, but neither man moved in a hurry. I suppose they already knew what they were going to see, and they only came halfway into the shelter, sparing themselves the worst of it. Errol didn't show any kind of remorse. He looked like a man encountering a nuisance, like he'd arrived to discover his basement was flooded. He simply turned to his attorney and asked, "Now what?" Jerry thought for a moment, then proceeded to outline a plan. "Hu-Ho will have to dial 911, so there's an official record of the call. And after yesterday's episode, I think the police will be surprised to hear from us so soon. But this time, fortunately, we have a much simpler story. Aiden was late for the wedding. The four of us came looking for him, and we found him like this. We have no idea why. We're all still in shock." Jerry looked from Errol to Hu-Ho to me. "Can we agree that's what happened?" Errol nodded, and Hu-Ho said, "Of course." And I asked, "What's the alternative?"
"I don't follow, Frank."
"I'm asking, what happens if I don't agree? Will the police show up and find my body next to Aiden's? Or do I just go missing, like Don Taggart? When does this end?" Jerry ignored my questions. He seemed to dismiss them as pointless.
"Right now, there are 300 people waiting for us at the Globe. I'll go there now and explain there's been a terrible accident. I'll break the news to Margaret and to Catherine, if she's lucid enough to hear it. After Hu-Ho calls the police, we'll start encouraging guests to be on their way. Meanwhile, you two men need to reach an understanding. You've got 10 minutes to get your shit together."
We followed them upstairs, out of the cellar. Hu-Ho and Jerry were already leaving the studio, but I paused to linger over Aiden's paintings, and Errol stayed with me. In the moment, I could think of no better way to honor Aiden's life than to stop and appreciate his artwork. All the black and white faces of regular people, all the nurses and teachers and line cooks and bus drivers. With their wrinkles and blemishes and imperfections, they didn't look anything like the wedding guests at Osprey Cove. And I wondered if maybe that was the point. "I don't know how you can live with yourself," I told Errol. "Your son was a good man and incredibly talented. And now he's dead because of you." He shrugged, casual, making it clear that none of my words had landed.
The truth's a little more complicated, Frank. Would you like to know it, or do you just want to judge me without having all the facts?
I couldn't believe he was going to try to defend his actions, and yet that's exactly what he proceeded to do.
About 15 years ago, I had a chance to invest in a little startup called Atavus Genetics. The company didn't survive. It was crushed by 23andMe because it was basically the same idea. You spit in a cup and mail it to their lab, and they sent back all the secrets of your DNA. The CEO gave me a bunch of sample kits to share with my friends, and on a whim, I decided to test my son. Back then, he was maybe 10 years old, and I was curious to see what he'd inherited from me. And it turns out, the answer was zero. Which might have surprised a lot of other people, but not me. The truth was, I always suspected it. The boy didn't look anything like me, and our personalities were totally different. He was always so timid, so cautious, so afraid. It was a genuine relief to know he wasn't mine. I decided to just leave him to Catherine and focus on my work.
Did anyone tell Aiden the truth?
I don't know. I certainly didn't.
So you just rejected him, but never explained why? Does that seem fair to Aiden?
I never stopped supporting him financially. His art didn't pay the rent on that penthouse apartment, believe me.
You owed him more than that. You should have behaved like his father or told him the truth, instead of leaving him to wonder why you hated him. Meryl had already stopped listening.
You're not going to make me feel guilty, Frank. I'm not the one who created this mess. I didn't bash in Dawn Taggart's skull. But your daughter is very much involved, so if you have concerns for her well-being, I suggest you follow my lawyer's advice. Jerry is very good at his job, and he'll work on your family's behalf, if you let him.
I knew he was right. I knew I'd have to stay on Gardner's standard time a little while longer and agree with their official story. But I also knew that Maggie's ties to the family had been severed. The wedding was off, and she was now a free woman. She could go anywhere, do anything, leave Osprey Cove and never return. Which was exactly what I planned to do.
7. Two police officers listened to my story and recorded my statement, but neither asked a lot of questions. They seemed eager to confirm that my recollections aligned with the statements given by Errol and Jerry, and then they sent me on my way. The entire conversation took less than 15 minutes. By the time I started back to my cottage, the lawn was empty. The caterers had carried away every last trace of the reception. It was all gone, like no part of the weekend had ever happened. The door to Blackbird was locked, and I had to use my phone to get inside. I called out for Tammy and Abigail, but to my surprise, the cottage was empty. I went upstairs to my bedroom, changed out of my tuxedo, and carefully placed all its components back in the garment bag. Then I pulled on my chinos and a t-shirt and a light fleece sweatshirt because I knew I would be driving all night, and I wanted to be comfortable. My suitcase was still on the lower bunk bed, and I unzipped the top. Inside the main pocket was an old manila envelope containing 10 $100 bills. I realized this had to be the gift that Aiden had mentioned, but I didn't understand the point of it. He promised the gift would keep me safe, but what kind of protection was $1,000 going to buy? I studied the envelope for secret markings or some other clue, but couldn't find anything. The money had the old musty scent of a used bookstore, and none of the bills were minted after 1953. So I suspected they were from a secret stash in the underground shelter,
Maybe Aiden was so naive about money, he thought $1,000 would make a real difference to a working-class schlub like myself. The thought made me angry, and I was tempted to leave the envelope in my cottage. But at the last second, I tossed it back into my bag, then piled all my dirty clothes on top of it. By 4:30, I was carrying my suitcase up to Osprey Lodge. I entered through the kitchen, where a 6 police officers were gathered around a buffet of sides and salads, all foods prepared for the reception and left behind by the caterers. Jerry was encouraging the officers to bring the trays home to their friends and families so the meals wouldn't go to waste. But at my arrival, they abruptly stopped talking and averted their eyes, like they felt ashamed of benefiting from my misfortune. I found Maggie and Tammy hidden away in the living room, sitting with the doors closed and the curtains drawn, and, just like the police, they stopped their conversation as soon as I arrived. Maggie occupied nearly the entire sofa in her billowing white lace gown. She had tissues in her hand and a box of Kleenex at her side, but all her makeup was still intact. Her cheeks were dry. "The police said we're free to go," I explained. "You two can say goodbye if you want, but I'll be waiting outside."
"You want to leave?" Tammy asked.
"It's over. Everyone's gone."
"The guests are gone. We're family. This is one of those occasions where we pull together and support one another."
"I don't support this at all, Tammy. 3 people are dead, and the only reason I'm keeping quiet is because of her." I pointed at Maggie, because I couldn't bring myself to address my daughter by name. "I'll wait 20 minutes so you can pack your things, but then I'm leaving, whether you're ready or not." Tammy understood I was serious and stood up, but Maggie didn't move. "There's nothing here for you anymore," I told her. "It's over. No marriage means no prenup. You get nothing." Maggie's expression suggested that these facts were still up for debate.
"It's definitely a change of plans," she said. "But I still have a lot of things to discuss with Errol. You and Tammy should leave. But I'm going to stick around a little longer."
I worried that if I left Maggie in Osprey Cove, she would never get away, that she would be bound to the Gardner family forever. But I was too tired to fight anymore. I couldn't keep rehashing the same arguments over and over. I hadn't eaten anything all day, and my back was killing me. I just wanted to lie down, close my eyes, and sleep. Instead, I had to drive 6 hours to the small, sad, desperate world that my daughter used to call home. Maggie gave us both hugs and promised to call the next day with an update. Then she announced that she was going upstairs to get changed.
"I had this dress altered 3 times, but it's just never fit me right."
She hitched up her train and walked out to the foyer, and we watched her climb up the stairs until she was gone.
"Well,"
Tammy said quietly,
"I'll get my things."
"Don't forget your stock shares." She flinched like I'd slapped her, and I wished I could take back the words.
"You know I already feel horrible," she said. "You don't need to make it any worse."
"I'm sorry, Tammy. I shouldn't have said that."
Was I angry that she took the shares and cheerfully suggested that we all just look the other way? Yes. But would I have done the exact same thing if our financial circumstances were switched? Almost definitely, yes. Tammy had spent her whole life cleaning up after other people's messes. She'd always been undervalued, unappreciated, and underpaid. 5 years of salary was life-changing money, and I wasn't going to judge her for taking it.
"I thought Aiden was okay with the situation," she said. "I thought the plan was his idea. If I had any inkling he was going to...
I put my arm around her so she wouldn't feel obliged to finish the sentence. "No one's blaming you, Tammy. This camp just messed with your head. All the money here. It makes people say and believe crazy things, and we just need to get the hell away from it. Where's Abigail?
Back at our cottage.
I explained that I had just come from the cottage. She wasn't there. When did you last see her?
Back at the Globe. When we all got the news, I told Abby to go to the cottage, and I followed Maggie here.
And that was the last time you saw her?
Time slipped away from me. I've been overwhelmed.
Go pack your stuff, I said. I'll find her. I looked all over the camp. I checked the beach, the dock, and the boathouse, and then I walked up to Big Ben, the climbing tree, where Abigail had jumped onto my shoulders and injured my back. Finally, in desperation, I went to the place where she was last seen, the Globe, where we'd all gathered for the ceremony. The stage was cleared and the string quartet was gone. The flower bouquets had been carried away and all the benches were empty, save for a single person in the back row. The last one at the wedding was a little girl with a crown of summer daisies hanging crookedly around her head. In her lap was a tiny basket of flower petals. She sat facing the stage and appeared to be waiting, like she was nurturing a small hope the ceremony might still begin. I took the seat beside her. Hey, Abby.
Hello.
Her voice was a sad little croak, and I realized she was crying. Of course she was crying. She'd been promised a fairy tale wedding. She'd been invited to witness the single greatest promise that any two people can make to each other. An extraordinary declaration of love and faith and commitment. And now Aiden was dead, and everyone was gone. And come Monday, Abigail would leave Tammy's condo and go live with some unknown mystery caregiver who might or might not look after her. I knew it had been a mistake to bring her. I said, "We're going to drive back now." And Abigail rubbed a knuckle into her eye and nodded. "So we need to get going, is what I mean." This just made her cry even more. Embarrassed, she put both hands over her face and turned away from me.
"I'm so sorry, Mr. Frank. I just..."
Her face was full of tears and snot, and I couldn't make out the rest. I pulled off my sweatshirt and used the soft fleece lining to gently dry her cheeks. She leaned forward and blew her nose into the fabric, and then apologized. I told her it was fine. I said, "Get it all out." And she honked her nose a couple more times and then took a deep breath, and at last she was clear. "Did Tammy tell you what happened?"
"She said there was an accident."
I nodded, because this was certainly all she needed to know. "I'm sorry it happened, Abigail."
"I feel so bad."
She doubled over, like she had stomach cramps, and gritted her teeth.
"I mean, it just hurts so much."
All the other wedding guests were already moving on with their lives. They were on their way home, heading back to reality. And here was the one person at Osprey Cove who shared all my pain and grief, who felt even worse than I did. "I'm hurting too," I said. "I'm sorry we put you through this, Abigail." I put my hand on her knee, and she sort of melted into my side, and we sat there, without talking, for a long time. Every so often, I felt my phone twitching. I was getting lots of text messages from my sister, who was looking all over for us, but I didn't bother to read any of them. I felt like Abigail deserved somebody's full attention, and right now that somebody was me. I don't remember how long we sat there, but after a while I noticed the sun was dropping. Soon it would be dusk. I thought maybe Abigail had fallen asleep, but then I cleared my throat and she stirred. "We have to get going. We'll both feel better if we leave."
"You really think so?"
"I'm sure of it." You'll feel a tiny bit better tomorrow morning, and a tiny bit better the day after that. Right now, we just need to push through it. Abigail nodded and pushed the fleece sweatshirt back into my lap. It was streaked with boogers and snot, so I just turned it inside out and wrapped it around my waist. Then I stood up, but she refused to budge. "Come on," I told her. "We gotta go." She raised her arms, asking me to carry her. I didn't think my back could handle it, but I agreed to give it a try. I held her little hand while she climbed up onto the bench. Then I lifted her by the waist and swung her onto my hip. I was surprised to discover she didn't weigh very much at all. With my free hand, I grabbed her basket of flower petals, and we set off down the trail to Osprey Lodge. Abigail hooked an arm around my shoulders, then used her free hand to scratch the side of her head. "Still itchy?" She nodded. "I thought Maggie called a doctor."
"She said she was gonna."
"But no one ever came?" Abigail shook her head, then scratched it some more, before resting it on my shoulder. And together we walked back to the camp. Part 5. Parting Gifts. 1. The next afternoon, I drove over to the men's warehouse in Stroudsburg to return my tuxedo. The kid with the pink hair and pierced eyebrows, the same kid who sold me the expensive accessory package, was standing behind the register. "Hey, welcome back. How did everything work out?" I mumbled something polite and got the hell out of there. The answer to his question was I still had no idea. I'd spent the previous evening driving back from New Hampshire with Tammy and Abigail. I dropped them off around midnight, and I was back in my own bed by 12:30, completely exhausted, but too wired to sleep. I kept waiting for my phone to ping with new information from Maggie, something to explain what was happening next. Despite her assurances, I couldn't stop worrying. At some point, I must have drifted off, but I was up early the next morning and immediately reached for my phone. Still no messages. I tried to busy myself with chores. I went into Maggie's childhood bedroom and stripped the sheets off her bed and put them into the washing machine. I know she said she was never coming home, but I wanted to be ready in case she changed her mind. After returning my tuxedo, I drove over to ShopRite and filled a grocery cart with her favorite foods. And all the while, I kept checking my phone, making sure I hadn't missed any calls. It was late in the afternoon before anyone reached out to me, and my stomach did a flip-flop when I checked the caller ID. It was Vicky, calling from Supercuts. I didn't want to answer, but I knew this conversation was inevitable.
"I'm sorry to bother you, Frank. I hope I'm not interrupting."
She said she'd heard what happened, and she was calling to express her condolences. Apparently, the story was all over the news, and she'd read about it on Facebook. I guess any time the son of a wealthy tech tycoon dies in a firearms accident just minutes before his wedding, you can count on algorithms and influencers to spread the word.
"How's Maggie coping?"
I didn't know how to answer that question. I wouldn't lie to Vicky, but I sure couldn't tell her the truth. "She's very confused."
"Of course she is. She's probably in shock."
"I wish I could help her. I don't know what to do." Vicky asked when I was driving back to Pennsylvania, and I explained that I was already home, that I'd been home all day.
"Oh, Frank, why didn't you say so? Do you want to meet up tonight? Talk about this over dinner?"
"I don't think so."
"You're welcome to come here. I've got food in my kitchen. I can put something together."
God, I wanted that more than anything. I was so desperate to tell her what happened, but of course, I could never tell anyone the truth, especially her. I'm not good company right now.
"I understand if you don't want to talk about it. I can respect that, Frank. You've been through a very traumatic experience, but I think, you know, psychologically, you could use a little emotional support.
And I knew that if I didn't get off the phone, I would agree. I would race to her house and tell her everything. So I pointed out that she wasn't a professional therapist.
What's that have to do with anything?
I don't think you should be giving me advice. You don't have any training in this stuff. You're just the person who cuts my hair. And I knew this hurt her. I could tell from her reaction, or rather her lack of reaction, and the long dead silence that followed.
I am not just the person who cuts your hair, Frank. I would have come to the wedding if you'd asked me sooner, if you hadn't waited until the last possible minute. It's not my fault I had to work.
I have to go, Vicky. I'm sorry. I ended the call and went over to the refrigerator where I kept all her business cards posted with magnets. I pulled them all down and put them in my trash so I wouldn't be tempted to call her back. It would be at least another month before I needed to get my hair trimmed, and I knew I could just drive to the other Supercuts, the one that was two towns away, in Mount Pocono. 2. About an hour later, my supervisor at UPS called to express his condolences. He reminded me that I had a massive bank of paid sick days, and he encouraged me to use them, so I could help my daughter with her bereavement. I assured him that Maggie was surrounded by friends, and the best thing for me was getting back to work. I promised to report first thing in the morning and drive my usual Monday route. Now, if I'd been paying any attention to the rest of the world, I might have noticed the heat wave in the forecast. The mayors of New York City and Philadelphia were already declaring states of emergency and encouraging residents to stay indoors, stay hydrated, and look after their elderly neighbors. Normally, I prepare for these shifts by filling an igloo cooler with ice packs and sliced watermelon and a couple of navel oranges. But Monday morning, I left my house with my usual ham and cheese sandwich, an apple, and a thermos full of water. I got my first inkling that it wasn't a normal day when I arrived at the package facility and found the managers passing out sun hats and cold sleeves and extra bottles of Poland Spring. Most UPS vehicles don't have air conditioning, so we were all reminded to pace ourselves and take frequent breaks. The guy who loads my truck is a Korean kid named Jun, and as I did my usual walk around, he warned me to be careful. You got a lot of dog food today, Frank. Dog food is warehouse slang for any absurdly heavy or irregularly shaped item that people buy online. Mattresses, cartons of printer paper, flat pack furniture, and, surprise, giant sacks of dog food. I thanked Jun for his heads up and tipped him a little extra, because loading all that dog food is hard work for him, too. I left my center at 8:30, and by 9 o'clock I was soaked in sweat. Outside my truck, the humidity was stifling, and inside my truck, a windowless metal box baking hotter and hotter under the rising sun, it was unbearable. Every time I went in back for a package, my pulse skyrocketed and sweat streamed down my forehead, stinging my eyes. And Jun was right. My deliveries included a shit ton of dog food. 9 of my customers had purchased window unit air conditioners to cope with the heat wave, and I had to hump these enormous boxes all the way up their long suburban driveways. My back was holding up okay, but after the 3rd or 4th air conditioner, I felt my hands and arms cramping up, a telltale symptom of heat stroke. So I stopped at McDonald's and rested in their air-conditioned dining room and drank a large orange high C. A quick break to regulate my body temperature. It was not quite 11 o'clock in the morning, and I still had another 139 parcels to deliver. I'd hoped that work would keep my thoughts off Maggie, but I couldn't stop worrying about her. Was she still in Osprey Cove? And where would she live now that Aiden was gone? Catherine Gardner had been so quick to tell me the truth, but what would happen if she ever confessed her sins to someone outside the family? Tammy claimed that wealthy criminals always got off scot-free, but I could name a dozen recent examples to the contrary. Jeffrey Epstein, Harvey Weinstein, Bill Cosby. The Gardners may have seemed invincible, but I wasn't so sure. I drove through a four-way intersection, and my travel computer beeped in error, warning me that I'd missed my turn and directing me to an alternate route. A tiny oversight that added 6 minutes to my workday. By 12:30, my arms were cramping up again, and my heart was revving like an engine stuck in neutral. I knew that I ought to stop and cool off, but there was no place to pull over. I was on a two-lane highway in a state forest, with shallow ravines on both sides of the road. I had traveled this route many thousands of times, but that day, the forest looked strange and unfamiliar. Like my windshield was filtering the view and saturating all the colors. I didn't realize it at the time, but this was probably the moment when I started to lose consciousness. And then, in the distance, I saw a car parked on the side of the road, hazard lights flashing, a bright red Honda Civic. There wasn't much of a shoulder, so most of the vehicle was resting in my lane. A woman knelt at the back of the car, cranking a jack and raising the rear left wheel off the pavement. A man waited nearby, holding a spare tire. And my broiling brain recognized these people as Don Taggart and Aiden Gardner. Wasn't this precisely how they met, changing a tire on the side of the road? I slowed my speed and drifted into the opposite lane to get around them. I craned my neck to take a better look at their faces, and my truck kept on drifting. My left front tire went off the asphalt and into the grassy ravine, and the soft earth immediately gave way. The steering wheel spun out of my hands, and the truck pivoted sideways. Everything in my windshield turned clockwise, like the world was revolving around me. Then the glass exploded, and I raised my hands to shield my face. The safety belt cut into my breastbone, pinning me to my seat. I clenched my hands into fists and braced myself for impact, as all my parcels toppled from their shelves and tumbled around and around my truck, like socks in the dryer. 3. I woke up in a hospital bed, with a broken arm, a broken nose, 3 cracked ribs, and symptoms of moderate heat stroke. But thankfully, no one else was hurt. The biggest casualties of the crash were my vehicle and my 26-year streak of accident-free driving. I was visited by a union rep who assured me I was at no risk of losing my job. Then I was visited by a suit from the corporate office who seemed a lot more ambivalent. I asked about my future with the company, and he simply answered, "Well, the investigation is still pending." That same day, I was visited by a reporter from the local newspaper in Scranton. She was writing a story about the appalling working conditions of delivery drivers. Her theory was that UPS management was somehow responsible for my accident, that the lack of air conditioning in my truck had nearly killed me. But I told her she had it all wrong. I insisted that I'd been properly trained to work in extreme temperatures, that I caused the accident through my own carelessness, and I wasn't going to start blaming others for my own dumb mistakes. The doctors kept me at Holy Redeemer for 3 nights, and plenty of people came to see me. Drivers, preloaders, and other assorted folks from the warehouse, but also Tammy, who brought me a phone and a charger, and even 2 of my favorite customers who'd heard about the crash on the local news. But a full 48 hours passed before I heard anything from Maggie. I thought she might rush home to see me, but instead she called from Boston, where she was helping the Gardners plan a memorial service for Aiden. She said it would be a small affair, immediate family only, and there was no reason for me or Tammy to attend. And maybe this was just the painkillers talking, but I told her I was fine. It's just a couple scratches, nothing to worry about. The next day, I went home with my right arm in a sling and a heavy plaster cast, and for the first time in 26 years, I found myself with absolutely nothing
to do. I tried watching daytime television, but holy mother of God, what happened to daytime television? When I was a kid, it used to be silly sitcoms and The Price is Right. Now it's just endless marathons of Dr. Pimple Popper and F-Boy Island. The cable news was even worse, with all the patriots hating California and all the progressives hating Florida and everyone hating Congress. All these shows made my blood boil, and I clicked off the TV, convinced that the whole stupid world was going down the toilet. I never heard another word from Armando Costado, but I suspect his thumb gently tipped the scales of my accident investigation. After a complete review of my vehicle's many sensors and computers and onboard cameras, the committee voted to put me on paid leave through pension, meaning that I would continue collecting my base salary for the next 3 years until I was eligible to retire, but I would never drive for UPS again. When I heard the news, I almost wept. I'd spent the last 26 years fantasizing about my last day on the job, but I never imagined it would end like this, in a windowless second-floor conference room with a half-dozen lawyers, execs, and union reps sitting in hard-backed chairs while I signed my name to endless waivers and releases. And after that happened, I had no reason to get out of bed in the morning. I had no reason to do much of anything. And I found myself falling into a pretty dark place. I stopped responding to texts and phone calls. I stopped looking after my house and started spending way too much time looking at my stupid phone. I wasted entire afternoons obsessing over the accident, replaying the details beat by beat and trying to pinpoint the exact moment I'd lost control. I remembered thinking the man on the side of the road looked exactly like Aiden Gardner, and I'd wanted to stop and ask him questions. Did he know if my daughter was okay? And why in the world had he left me $1,000? I still had the envelope of $100 bills stashed inside my dresser because I felt too guilty to deposit them in my bank account. It was late in August, 9:30 on a Tuesday morning, when my sister roused me from sleep with an unexpected phone call. She'd been offered a gig caring for an Alzheimer's patient in Pocono Pines, and she needed me to watch Abigail for a couple of days. A couple days? Just until school starts. This job pays $50 an hour, and I can't say no to that kind of money. I hadn't seen Abigail since we'd left Osprey Cove, and the last I'd heard was that she'd gone back to live with her birth mother. Only there must have been some kind of problem, because a week later, Abigail moved to an orchard in Kutztown. One of these family farm operations, where six or eight fosters bunk together and help with chores after school. That must not have worked out either, because now Abigail was back in my sister's condo. I can't do it, Tammy.
Why not? What are you doing today?
The answer was nothing, but I was too groggy to dream up a decent excuse. I'm still wearing my cast. How can I babysit with a broken arm?
You don't have to lift her. She's not an infant.
I can't do it. I'm sorry. She hung up, so I thought the matter was settled and fell back to sleep. But 20 minutes later, I could hear Tammy unlocking my front door, and when I stumbled out to my living room, Abigail was standing there, with a pencil case and a Sudoku magazine, wearing sneakers and shorts and a backpack, like she'd just arrived for summer camp.
Hey, Mr. Frank.
Where's Tammy?
She just left. She said she'd be back at 7:30.
7:30 tonight?
I think. Sorry.
Abigail looked different than I remembered. All the lice were gone, and she was growing out her hair. Now it was an awkward, shaggy length between a buzz cut and a bob. She removed her backpack but stopped short of placing it on the floor, like she wasn't sure where to put it, or herself. You can have the couch, I told her. I'll take the recliner.
She moved to sit down and tripped on a plank of wood, part of the homemade coffee table that I still hadn't finished assembling. I apologized for the mess and opened the curtains to let more light into the room. And this just made everything look worse. I'd let my housekeeping slide, and there were little drips of coffee and Chinese food all over my furniture. I handed the TV remote to Abigail and told her we could watch anything she wanted. Or you can go play outside, but stay off the train tracks. She took a walk to scope out the neighborhood and came back after 20 minutes, claiming there was no one around. You used to see lots of kids on my block, riding dirt bikes or just barting around, but now I guess they all stay inside and look at the internet. Abigail turned on the TV and we spent the day watching shark documentaries on the Discovery Channel, hours of exclusive interviews with marine biologists and shark attack survivors. Sometimes Abigail would work on her puzzle book, and when she got bored of that, I gave her a roll of paper towels to draw on. And when she got hungry, I sent her down the street to the Exxon Mobil with money for a hot dog and pretzel, because I couldn't motivate myself to cook anything. The next day was more of the same, but sometime in the afternoon, I fell asleep in my recliner, and when I opened my eyes, Abigail was gone. On my television screen, a shark was silently prowling through cloudy red water in search of its next meal. I wondered if maybe Abigail had walked to the gas station for another hot dog. Instead, I found her in Maggie's bedroom, going through my daughter's dresser and quietly inspecting all her things. I watched from the doorway as she touched the old sports trophies, then sifted through a drawer of neatly folded sweaters. Then she knelt beside a wicker basket full of stuffed animals and pulled out the Build-A-Bear that Maggie had designed some 15 years ago on our trip to the King of Prussia Mall near Philadelphia. "You can have that if you want," I said. Abigail hadn't realized I was watching. She was so startled she dropped it.
"Really?"
"Anything in that basket, you can take. You might as well. Maggie's never coming back here." I didn't know it was true until I said it out loud. In the month since the wedding, my daughter's job had taken her all over the world, to Singapore and London and Los Angeles, but nothing was drawing her back to Stroudsburg, not even the accident that shattered my ribs and landed me in the hospital. I opened the closet and gestured to all the colorful dresses on hangers. "This stuff is fair game, too. Help yourself." Abigail had zero interest in the clothes, but she dragged the wicker basket out to the living room and began to inventory its contents. SpongeBob, Curious George, lots and lots of Beanie Babies. She marveled over every item before setting it on the couch. Shark Week was still playing on the television, but I switched it off and just watched Abigail play with the toys. I hadn't seen her this excited since Osprey Cove. I suddenly felt an overwhelming urge to escape the funk of my house and leave it all behind. I stood up and grabbed the keys to my Jeep. "Come on," I told her.
"Where are we going?"
"I don't know. Anywhere." That first afternoon, we just drove around the neighborhood. I took her to the patch of highway where I crashed my UPS truck and showed her how I went off the road. And then we drove past St. Luke's, the church where Colleen and I were married, and Silvio's, the Italian restaurant where we'd had our wedding reception. I didn't expect Abigail to be interested, but she had scores of questions. How many guests did we invite? What was the song for our first dance? What was Italian food anyway? This last question blew my mind. How do you get to be 10 years old without tasting Italian food? So we went inside, and I explained the situation to the waitress. She was happy to bring us little sample plates of all the house specialties. Gnocchi, bruschetta, risotto, lasagna, chicken parm, broccoli rabe. We ate until we were stuffed. And then Abigail said she'd never had tiramisu. she'd never even had gelato. So we had to order those, too. It made me happy to see her looking so happy. Honest to God, it felt like the first meaningful thing I'd accomplished all summer. So the next day, I tried to do it again. We made a whole long list of things she'd never experienced, and then we spent the rest of the summer experiencing them. We toured Crystal Cave and the Hershey Chocolate Factory. We ate dinner at Shady Maple, the largest smorgasbord buffet in America, and at Shogun Palace, one of those Japanese places where they cook everything right in front of you. We even drove down to Philadelphia so she could attend her first Major League Baseball game. It was a lot of traveling, but it felt good to be back on the road, driving with the windows down and the music way up. For the last day of summer vacation, I wanted to do something really special, so I brought Abigail to Casey's Canoes on the Delaware Water Gap. I hadn't been there since Maggie was a kid, but the place was just like I remembered. They rented watercrafts and provided transportation up the river, and they even sold brown bag lunches with sandwiches and apples and juice boxes. Within the hour, Abigail and I were riding on a big yellow school bus full of rowdy teenagers. With my arm still in a cast, everyone looked at me like I was crazy. The bus driver asked how I planned to make it down the river, and I explained that Abigail would do all the work. The Delaware River is long and wide, and most of the year it runs really slow. If you're looking for whitewater action, it's a massive disappointment. But if you're a 10-year-old just getting started, it's the perfect place to learn. After 30 minutes of coaching, Abigail was paddling with confidence and steering us around boulders and bridge piles. For lunch, we found a little island full of families and stopped there to eat our sandwiches. I found a nice seat in the shade of a weeping willow while Abigail splashed around in the water with some kids. And to my great surprise, I found myself wishing that summer didn't have to end. 4. But the summer did end, so Tammy assured me I was off the hook and my childcare services were no longer required. I kept helping out anyway, just to make things easier for my sister. If Abigail had math club after school, I made sure she arrived on time. I brought her to a pediatrician to get all her shots up to date. I found a good dentist to fill her many cavities, and he referred us to an orthodontist who peered inside her mouth with wonder and awe, like he'd just been presented with the greatest technical challenge of his career. "She's going to need a lot of braces," he announced. And then I spent a week on the phone with Pennsylvania Medicaid, begging them to cover the costs. They kept trying to steer me to a cheaper provider, but I wanted the job done right. So I ended up paying most of the bill myself. I wasn't going to let some jackass ruin her teeth. By October, the three of us had settled into a nice daily routine. One afternoon, my sister hit a snag at work and asked me if I could get Abigail from school. So I picked her up in my Jeep and brought her to Tammy's condo. I made tacos for dinner while Abigail sprawled out on the living room floor with her homework. After we finished the dishes, we watched a little Netflix together, one of these cooking shows where complete morons attempt to bake with disastrous results. And then I sent her upstairs to bed. I gave her a half hour to read, and then I stopped by her bedroom to say, "Lights out."
"5 more minutes?" she asked. "Please?"
She was reading a fantasy novel about warrior cats, and she swore she was 10 pages from the end. 5 minutes, I agreed, but you better be asleep when Tammy gets home, or I'll catch all kinds of hell. Abigail flashed me a thumbs up and returned to her book, and as I turned to leave, I noticed a map pinned to her wall, just above her dresser. She had recently gone on a decorating spree, papering her bedroom with mazes, crossword puzzles, Sudoku grids, Disney movie posters, and glossy advertisements cut for magazines. And the map was half hidden amid the clutter. It was a small topographical drawing of Lake Wyndham, specifically the square mile or so fronting Osprey Cove, with wavy contour lines and numbers detailing the elevation of the land and the depths of the water. Abigail? What is this?
The summer camp.
Where did you get it?
Aiden gave it to me.
When? She shrugged.
When we got back from New Hampshire, I found it in my suitcase, in the side pocket. I think because Aiden knew I liked geography, so he wanted me to have it.
I looked more closely at the picture. It looked like a photocopy of a much larger map, the kind of navigational tool used by boaters and fishermen. Someone had used a pencil to sketch in some additional features. The boathouse, the L-shaped dock, and Osprey Lodge. But the most notable addition was a bright red X in the deepest section of the water. An irregularly shaped crater with a depth of 52 meters. How do you know it's from Aiden?
There's a note on the back,
Abigail said.
You can take it off the wall if you want to read it.
I carefully unpinned the map and then turned it over to read the message. This could be helpful someday. Don't be afraid to use it. Aiden. Abigail saw the confusion on my face and offered a theory.
I think it's a treasure map.
You do?
One day, I'm going to go back to Osprey Cove and look for the X. I'll buy a scuba suit to see what's down there. You should come with me.
Have you shown this to anyone? Has Tammy seen it? Abigail shook her head.
She says we're not supposed to talk about Osprey Cove. She says that if DHS knew what happened there, we would all get in trouble.
I felt like I was going to be sick. I knew I had to choose my next words very carefully. Abigail, listen to me. I think you got this map by mistake. I don't think Aiden meant for you to have it. Her expression turned suspicious, and I quickly explained. I think Aiden wanted to give you money. I think he wanted to give you $1,000. She thought I was teasing her.
Very funny, Mr. Frank.
No, I'm serious. I proceeded to outline my theory. I told her that Aiden had left $1,000 in my suitcase because he didn't realize Abigail and I had switched bedrooms. You were in the master suite, and I was in the kids' room. So he put the money in my suitcase, and he put this map in yours.
That's crazy. Are you kidding me? $1,000?
By this point, she had cast her book aside and was standing up on her mattress in her pajamas.
Do you still have it?
I do. I haven't spent a single penny.
Then will you trade it with me?
I don't think she ever imagined I would say yes, but I agreed it was the fair thing to do. I had $84 in my wallet, and I gave her all of it, with a promise to put the rest in a savings account. I told her I would try to get her a bank book, if they still made them, so she could keep track of her wealth and grow it with future deposits. Abigail fanned the bills with an eye-popping grin, like the lottery winners in a Mega Millions commercial. But I could barely hold on to the map, because my hands had started to shake.